another edition of Lena Live. I have a few kind words to express to BBS Radio, as usual. And I also, with tremendous enthusiasm, like to introduce my guest, Dr. Keith Maron, whose accomplishments are so widespread in the most relevant, or one of the most relevant, relevant qualities in our life, is leadership. This word somewhat was overused, but I would say this with particular caution, because in the creation, in thinking and expression of Dr. Maron, this word has such a fantastic expansion of qualities and such a tremendous direction in our everyday life. I would go in a very small increment in every moment in our life, and leading to the major leadership in great companies where his talent was used and was taking advantage in the best possible way. We will be talking to him about his new book, which is devoted to leadership. It has name The Golden Flame. And during the course of the program, I certainly will mention his credentials, which are tremendous, starting from his Harvard life and going to the major companies in the country, and also major institutions, which had to give him an opportunity to 25 years experience in assisting executive managers, business, government, education, and also very fine teacher. So on this note, I like to invite to our discussion my very noble guest, Dr. Keith Maron. Keith, how are you doing?
Thank you. I'm a little already overwhelmed. but thank you. I'm doing well. What a wonderful introduction.
Well, no, thank you. You certainly deserve more than that. I'm sure that we will go to some smaller, as I would say, intimate increments of the leadership. And I like to ask you the first question, which perhaps somewhat bigger than I wanted to ask, but we will take our time and we will take this with all details. What is the difference in your understanding and your concept between leadership in business and leadership in personal life?
Well, I'm not so sure there is much of a difference in the way in which I see the world. To me, the essence of leadership is inspiring others. And so inspiration can happen in all walks of life. So, you know, there are no classic definitions of leadership. They're all over the place. People's definition of leaders are quite wide and varied. One of the classic distinctions between leadership and management, where managers, they control, direct, guide, and measure, and leaders inspire. Leaders provide vision. Leaders provide a way of seeing and a way of being that causes others to shift. But for me, if you think about leadership in its essence as inspiration, then inspiration belongs everywhere. And the qualities and forces that cause others to be inspired belong in all realms. I just happen to do a lot of work in the area of business because it's an area that I'm fascinated with, but you can apply the same principles that we'll be talking about today in education, in schools, you can apply in nonprofits, in any walk of life, even in a family. The essence of leadership still applies.
That's the reason why I was particularly fascinated by your book, because indeed there is no borderline. Because when you're talking about certain personal quality, And you're so open, you're incredibly sincere about this, taking chances with freedom of expression, for which I personally thank you so, so much, because younger generation is craving to have such a guidance, and they don't have it. So you are describing anger, personal ambition, greed, resentment, and all of this comes as a natural course of human development, and you're addressing this with the leadership. So let's go to those personal characteristics which you're using in your everyday practice.
Well, we might want to go a little deeper, or at least start with the question of what inspired me to write this book, and I think that will indirectly get to what are the qualities that are made up of great leadership. Would it be okay if I kind of take a pause and talk a little bit about what got me started with this?
Absolutely, and I'm sorry to actually interrupt you and
no worries.
Longer answer to this. The only reason I did not follow this very noble routine starting from introduction of your book, which is so diligently written, I just was a little impatient, a little anxious to get into this personal bouquet of characteristics and then build our way to the beginning, then perhaps to the middle of the book, because you have some fantastic personal experiences and you bring in some other characters and their true life stories. So whatever which way you go, I'm sure you will hit the right stone.
Oh, thanks. Well, so the inspiration for the book was this question, a rather simple question, and it's this, that all over the world for hundreds of years there have been books written on leadership, and to the point where almost anybody who's interested in the subject of leadership will have read the same kinds of things, that great leadership is comprised of vision, integrity, it's comprised of determination and drive, it's comprised of courage, et cetera, et cetera. And almost everybody you would ask, and you could ask them what are the characteristics and qualities of great leaders, they would list those things. And yet, in spite of the 6,000 books that have been published on leadership, I would say that leadership has not improved in the world in any way, shape, or form. And I was keenly interested in that. Why is that? Why is it that we know so much about leadership? That there are millions of leaders throughout the world, and yet leadership is not improving. And I'm happy to give you the data for why I believe that's so. But if we operate from the premise that leadership is not improving, then the question would have to be asked why. And the answer is that leadership is not a cognitive process. In other words, knowing about what it takes to be a leader and being a great leader are not at all the same things. Being a great leader requires one to face oneself. And so the book was about the question, what are the forces inside of a person that gives rise to those qualities? What are the forces that would cause them to come to the forefront? Why is it that some people bring it and others don't? So the answer to your question would be the same thing that just about everybody else writes about. The qualities that are great leadership are vision, integrity, determination, courage, et cetera, et cetera. My question is deeper. And so I would want to talk about what are the forces that would bring it out in you or in me or in the world.
I would say that one need to deserve the quality of the leader. And to be extraordinarily honest, as you pinpoint, in their personal everyday little tasks, there is no place for some kind of a compromise.
Yeah.
To create and to build this power and energy, and to have this very clear, uncompromising vision, you almost have to see yourself as an engine, but the world as the goal, as a tremendous sense of the responsibility.
Yeah.
So you started to move the world around your own engine, but you have to be, to say the least, good enough, educated enough, uncompromising to be flexible and vigilant. And all of this is incredibly difficult and sometimes compromised in our modern society. And I think to bring my personal point to your very strong point that there are so many books are written, and that's why I said that leadership word sometimes overused, but still it is getting more and more unique to find a great leader. I believe that analogy here, in a sense, a friend and the enemy, because people are getting more isolated, they are functioning through the computer, and a computer becomes their leader, when indeed they're forgetting about themselves, about who they are, and the computer is only the tool. My next question is, how can we find this invisible balance between leadership in our own depth, personal sense, using beauty and convenience of the technology?
Boy, I'm not so sure we can. And it's because the technology is, we're talking about the internet and the computer. Words on a page and images on a page tend to appeal to the mind. So if you think of all of us as made up of mind, body, and spirit, and body relates to emotions. You know, the word emotion is emotion, motion being movement. And our bodies, our emotions are located in our body. And spirit, of course, is in a completely different realm that courses through all and everything. So the technology tends to appeal to the mind. You read things on a page in a computer, you scroll down, you do searches, and you're looking for information that appeals to the cognitive level. And yet, interestingly, great leaders, while they may use technology as a tool, they are great not because they're just cognitively well developed. They're great because their mind, body, and spirit are all well developed. And so it's very hard to develop oneself purely through technology. In fact, you could become extremely imbalanced. It's one of the reasons why I have some difficulty with, you know, the kids these days, they use the telephone, they do the back and forth, what is it called, when they're sending text messages. So they're exchanging information, typically at a fairly cognitive level. They get very fast at it, but it doesn't lend itself to a direct human connection, and it lends itself to surface conversations, whereas when you're on the phone or when you're face-to-face, much more richness can be interacted, and leaders in this day and age or in any day and age are much more well-developed in all three, mind, body, and spirit. So it's tough. I think it's a tool, but not a substitute for true leadership.
Yes, frankly, I somewhat did not expect a very optimistic answer in your reading of that. And the reason I posed this question, because it is inevitable, because I think there is that much more responsibility and that much more charisma goes for people like yourself, who is fortunately donating and sharing his time to the teaching. So you do face a student body, their minds, and I'm sure you're engaging in this very vital exchange. There is nothing can obviously substitute a human thought, whether it's a right or wrong. I would make just a philosophical comment, perhaps, because dialectic always surviving, and perhaps at some point when future generation will have benefits of improved education, then there is a somewhat more of an optimistic balance between human and technical interaction. I think the fact that our education in a such unfortunately frail condition, there is somewhat laziness, which is playing great role in the human interaction. And yes, in addition to this texting, and I don't call it Facebook, I call it mind-lifting book, you know, when they correspond to each other through, again, either pictures or short phrases. It's a shortcut communication, which is anything but true leadership. I like to ask you, however, going to your personal and professional accomplishments, you've been working for many companies, and just to mention few, you either made a consulting impact or you made some positive improvement. But a company like Freddie Mac, like America Group Corporation, like Medcas, like Wang Laboratories, General Public Utilities, this is a giant corporation. How did you place yourself with your skill, with your strong individual professional preferences with these giant companies?
How did I what? I'm sure I didn't get the first part. How did I?
How did you place yourself? How did you find yourself?
How did I get there?
Not really get in terms of your work, but how did you feel about yourself as an individual?
You know, it's interesting. I used to work for pretty large companies, and I found it somewhat frustrating on two levels. One, they're huge beasts that are very, very difficult to transform. The larger the organization, the more the systems and the processes are baked into the system, and the harder it is to change it. And since my work is about transforming organizations and people, I found the larger the company, the harder, for obvious reasons. And there's some research that shows that, on average, to make a significant cultural change in an organization, a large organization takes typically 7 to 10 years. And part of the problem that I found is that the CEOs would stay for maybe 3 to 5 years in these large corporations. The board of directors would pull them out after 2, 3, or 4 years if they weren't producing significant results. So the pressures on Wall Street, the pressures in the economy, and the pressures from the board for producing results short term cause these CEOs to come and go. And it takes a CEO to stick with it for a long, long time. So what would happen is we'd be involved with a major change effort, cultural change effort in the company, then it wouldn't produce results immediately. It's not meant to. And the CEO would be ousted. Another CEO would come in with a very different regime and a very different intention, very different effort, and then we wouldn't be involved anymore. And that just happened enough times that I realized that that was just too frustrating for me. The second reason why it was somewhat frustrating is because the larger the company, the more there are politics. And that stands to reason because you get, in larger companies, leaders tend to enjoy power. They enjoy influence. They enjoy the bigness of the organization. It feeds their ego. It feeds their something in them. Sometimes it feeds their soul. And so they get very practiced at playing politics. And the more the political the organization, the less satisfying it was for me. Because if nothing else, as you saw in my book, I am just very authentic and very real. And emotionally, spiritually, and intellectually, I tell the truth. And you've got to learn how to wend your way through the truth sometimes in political systems. So it didn't fit me very well. And I ended up working with smaller companies, and I've been much more satisfied. I'd be working with a CEO, And many of the CEOs that I work with, they don't like politics, and they try to create a much more authentic and healthy culture. So I've moved in the direction from big to small and been happier for it. It's just more fit the nature of who I am. At the same time, I am working with some very large organizations where we're trying to help them create more inclusive cultures. And because of the nature of that work around inclusiveness, I find myself enjoying working with some CEOs and major corporations throughout the world that are not very political, and they really are committed to inclusiveness. So there may be 5% of the companies, large companies in the world, that fit who I am, and I seem to be finding those and working once again with bigger companies in my career.
You are fantastically fortunate. Certainly to find, needless to say, any place in this challenging, complex world, but you found your niche where you can function and express yourself with very little compromise. My congratulations, and I'm so thrilled that you have this unique and powerful satisfaction. I like to go to a few episodes which you described in your book. One, I will give my personal interpretation, but I'm not sure if that's exactly what you meant. But I'd like to have your comment, because I'm sure for the listeners, and especially for younger future executives, this example should be understood in a very detailed way. You're describing a gradual collapse of, taking this back, it's too strong, gradual decline of Michael Eisner, Disney World person. And if I understood correctly, you described, you made some definite points where Mr. Eisner alienated himself from many people, including Walt Disney's nephew, who is remind of the whole company. So my perception and conclusion was that Mr. Eisner perhaps was very brilliant, a super businessman for the Wall Street, which in fact admired him until the very end of his decline, but he was not suitable at all for the theme and for the concept of the Disney World. And that's why he became useless eventually.
Yeah, you know, I think that may be possible. I was not intimately involved, so I only understand that particular story, Eisner's involvement, through the media. But in my way of reading, I think that's very possible. There's another way of interpreting it that I would offer, which is that he came on board about 20 years ago, maybe 15, I think it was 15 or 20, at a time when Disney was hurting severely. And Disney, as a company, needed a savior. It needed somebody who was powerful and confident and photogenic, who could inspire a significant shift. And Eisner is extremely ambitious, some say extremely arrogant, that often goes with the territory of some strong leaders, is that they can be arrogant. He was very sure of himself, and he came on board, and he was a breath of fresh air. And he indeed orchestrated a significant turnaround of the company, and he inspired the company to go in some important directions. Some of the movies that started to come out were adult and very popular and more modern. Disney, in its adult realm, was known for Mary Poppins and, you know, certain Western adventures, but it started to produce movies that were more edgy. And Eisner was at the forefront of that. And Eisner also hired the guy who brought back Disney's animation movies, you know, the Lion King and the Aladdin and others were under Eisner's helm. So you could say he did a lot of good things, but he was extremely enamored with himself. He was very narcissistic, very arrogant, and he alienated a lot of people because of his interpersonal style. It was so much about him that he was trying to become almost like Walt Disney. He was personally trying to, it appeared, to be bigger than life. And after a while, that turned people off. And he believed he was bigger than the board, bigger than the industry, you know, and demonstrating behaviors that were so self-centered that Walt Disney's nephew, I think it's Walt Disney Jr., I'm not sure, I can't remember his first name, just felt like, hey, you're just trying to replace the brand with yourself, and that's not acceptable, and your arrogance is the problem. And so what was a strength eventually became a weakness, and Eisner couldn't see it because he was so enamored with the picture in the mirror, you know, when he looked at himself.
Well, thank you for bringing this broader picture, which is, I think, a wonderful extension to this example which you're describing in the book, which brings another point. I think someplace in the beginning of your book, you're expressing exactly that thought that it is a leadership is to give. It's to... I was impressed with your wording, which basically expressed a selfless and a totally committed lack of any self-centered qualities, movement, thinking, and eventually production of the leadership. So I almost felt like a picture of stages where I felt I'm learning about the world, how I can correspond to the world, and what is my placement in the world. And there is nothing wrong not to be a leader. There is nothing wrong to be a follower. The world needs all types of individuals. But this leadership is extremely uncompromised personal characteristics. And I think that's what you've been talking about, that it is one of the major points of your book to express the idea of, if I would say, giveness more than self-centered.
Very much. And I do make a distinction that I think you're picking up on between inner-focused versus outer-focused and inner-directed versus outer-directed. So somebody who's inner-directed is guided by their inner self. They're guided by their own inner compass. They have a clear sense of what their direction is in life. And that's a very powerful feature. If you're very other-directed, it means that other people then dictate what your inner life is like. So people who are inner-directed have kind of a golden flame inside of them, clear about who they are and where they're going. However, if you take inner directed and then become inner focused, that's narcissism. That means I'm directed by myself in the direction of my own needs. So great leaders are also outer focused, meaning that their focus is on making a difference in the outer world in a positive way. They're focused on the needs of other people. They're in service to the world. Eisner was in service too much to himself. Now, I'm sure in his own mind, he was also in service to the world, but the balance seemed to be way too much in the direction of his own light. You can use Gandhi as a beautiful example. Gandhi is a very strong person, very inner-directed, guided by a belief in himself and a belief in the possibilities of what he represented. And yet, his intention was to make a difference in the outer world. And that's what great leaders are. And it requires, you say unwavering, and I think that's right. Great leadership is unwavering. great leadership is an authentic expression of who I am. And if I'm clear about who I am and I'm good with who I am, then why would I waver? I might learn and I might grow, but I would not waver from the core of who I am.
And I jumped because you trigger another thought, which will bring perhaps another dimension and perhaps touch of a complexity to this conversation. But that's what your fantastic book is all about. It is endless conceptualizing of life, especially today. And leadership today has quite a different taste than a leadership, let's say, 50, 60 years ago. We're going into political sphere, and because your mind and your knowledge is so universal, I will take advantage of your vision and will make a few comments when you talk about this narcissistic self-absorption. I have to confess that we're talking about one of the two outstanding examples of it, and this is dictatorship. It's Stalin in Russia and Hitler in Germany being extremely self-absorbed people, and their fear and insecurities were described and documented in graphic details, yet they became a superpower, and look what they did to the world.
Yes.
Point I'm trying to make and the question to ask with this, what is your feeling and what is your understanding? How is style or genre of leadership is changing, and what type of leadership is classic for our modern society?
Yeah, well, you know, you use some examples of the past, but there's also some enormous positive examples of leadership in the past. And by the way, Walt Disney is one of my favorites. I think Walt Disney was an extraordinary example of a human being who, by virtue of his inner solidity and his outer vision, created something amazing in the world. At the same time, you know, that Stalin and Hitler were in their regimes. So I'm not so sure the past example of power would be dominating and imperialistic. I think the past, what defines the past, is more the world was much more stable 50, 75 years ago. Things were more known. Things were more, you can predict the future a little more clearly. And so being able to lead by being more a consistent manager was very helpful, whereas now the world is changing so much that what defines a great leadership in an organization and a great visionary leader is not somebody who can manage well, but who can create the future. So if you think about 30 or 40 years ago, we were talking about organizations needing to adapt, meaning the world is changing around us and the organization needs to adapt to those changes, and if it does, it will become more effective. Well, 70 years ago, adaptation wasn't in the conversation. It was more learning how to be more efficient. So it went from learning how to be more efficient to learning how to adapt to now learning how to create. And most of the great organizations of this day and age are not ones that adapted to anything, but they're ones that created something anew. Starbucks, eBay, Amazon.com, Hewlett-Packard, Apple, even IBM of sorts, are all examples of companies and of leaders who had an image of the future when the future did not exist, and then went to create that imagined future. That's the big difference between 50 years ago and now. It's the ability to create that which doesn't exist. So it requires imagination far more than it used to, and I think Disney is a great example of an early pioneer in this more imaginatory leadership. But that more and more is crucial in this day and age. And because it's more imaginative, then it's more right brain oriented. Used to be you can be a great leader and be purely left brain. Now, as Daniel Pink writes about in his book around right brain, you've got to be much more balanced left and right, and you can argue that great leadership in the future is going to be much more right brain than left because of the imaginative qualities that are acquired.
Well, I can see that little boy is still living in the greatness of Dr. Keith Maron, since Disney became a wonderful leading example of our conversation, which brings very refreshing and more understandable reality, frankly, because everyone knows Disney's and everyone knows all this connections between fairy tales and reality. So I'm grateful that you could make these connections between hardcore business and such a gentle and beautiful world of Disney. I will just make a little break and to make sure that our listeners are aware of the fact that we are talking to Dr. Keith Maron, founder and CEO, and gentleman who has a tremendous experience in basically every level of leadership, whose mind doesn't know the difference whether it's a personal or business, whose mind is so adaptable and so gifted to relate his ideas and knowledge to the small company and to a big enterprise. So to make sure that we are all aware of his accomplishments, I wanted to go back to his book and talk about one of the personality, I believe it's a real person, by name Chauncey Starr. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, yes.
He is 93 years old, and he said something which took my soul. He said, "I do not see myself as a leader. I just like to solve big problems." I found that very revealing and very honest and very charming. Who is this gentleman?
Chauncey Starr is the founder and former CEO of a company called EPRI. EPRI is the Electrical Power Research Institute. And EPRI is known in the electrical utility industry as a bastion of forward thinking for the electrical utility industry. So basically, Chauncey, about 40 years ago, had the awareness that the electrical utility industry is becoming a commodity. Basically, if you plug your plug into the wall in China and you plug it in here, you get the same stuff. It's electricity. In electricity, there are standards that ensure that all electricity flows in the same way. And so in a commodity industry, there's enormous pressure to produce products and services cheaper and cheaper. There's not a lot of pressure to develop more innovative ways of producing. There's just a lot of pressure to reduce the costs of that product. So very little development, research and development has gone into the electricity industry for 40 years. He realized that, and because there's so little money for research and development, you and I have enjoyed cost-cutting related electricity, but there's not much money to develop in a more efficient way or a more or green way, you know, ways that is sustainable for the planet. So he decided to pool all of the efforts of the electric utilities around the country together, have each of them put a little bit of money in a pot, and have together they can develop new technology. That was the inspiration behind it, and it was brilliant, and so much of the innovations that we've experienced the past 4 years as a direct result of that thought process and that effort. And Chauncey is just a wonderful man. Yeah,
truly tremendous. I will make totally, I don't know, unrelated example. but the great conductor of the symphony orchestra, speaking about diversification of the leadership, which you so eloquently and so clearly described in your book, one can think of another dimension, and I like to make this parallel. There are great conductors who had literally endless life, and some musicians did not like their personalities by all means. In fact, they call them as dictators, they call them as a terrorist.
Yes,
yet
yes.
It was phenomenal. And the reason I'm making this example, because number of conductors been living very long life, maybe few reached 93, but quite a few came to that age. And the longer they've been living, the greater their leadership became, because even though there was different appreciation of their greatness, but there was a contact, there was a communication. It was that tremendous knowledge where a conductor was connecting to the whole orchestra as a body, like a big company, and yet he knew every musician, every intonation, thinking about tiny, a little, small company. So my question, perhaps somewhat philosophical, would it be a fair statement that even in a big company, there are segments, or there are some segments of a small companies where company will function successfully only when those small portions of leadership will be just as effective as a general CEO leadership?
Are you saying, are there places where the company's success is dependent upon the leadership of people in middle and lower levels?
Correct.
Yeah, oh yeah. I think so, and in fact, I think the more, if you think about, again, back to your question of how's the world changing and how does that affect leadership, top-down control used to be the primary definer of great leadership. We used to call it command and control leadership. And that works in a relatively stable environment. But when the environment is changing so much, and where innovation and inspiration must be cultivated throughout the organization, you can't quite use the command and control style of leadership to its greatest effect. There are very few successful companies whose primary dependence is on greater efficiency. Greater efficiency is useful, but because we're in a creation age as opposed to a control age, then you've got to push down not just responsibility, you've got to cultivate a sense of responsibility from people all over the place in an organization.
And I think, sorry to interrupt you, I think if that takes place, it will counterbalance some negative political elements, which can be sometimes very destructive, if I'm on the right track with your thought.
Very much so, very much. In fact, the more you want to encourage the cultivation of responsibility throughout and initiative throughout the organization, it's a wonderful antidote to the politics that typically happens. Politics is driven by people who are personally ambitious. Most people in leadership positions have some personal ambition. But if it's too much ambition, this is why Chauncey Starr was so beautiful. You know, he said, I don't know that I'm such a great leader. I just like to solve problems. He didn't think of himself as a leader. He didn't care about becoming a leader. He wasn't ambitious to be a leader. He wanted to simply solve important problems for the betterment of the world, and he liked the bigger the better for his point of view. So it's an antidote to ambition. Personal ambition creates political dynamics. Too much personal ambition creates overbloated politics, which then reduce the degree to which people feel trust, which then reduce the degree to which people will want to take responsibility.
We are facing the end of our program, unfortunately, and I wanted to accomplish two final thoughts. One if you kindly can describe your very first experience of your very first responsible position, that it was somewhat painful experience, and yet it was obviously discovery of the world. What does it take? You describe this in your book, again, with honesty and your emotional attitude to this. Could you walk us through?
Well, I'm not sure which one you're referring to.
The one which you've been hired, you've been giving some semi-executive position, and you expressed yourself, but it was not very successful because I believe you've been listening more to your own self-conviction.
Oh, yeah. Well, there probably were more than one example of that, but the one that comes to mind is I was in a large computer company. It was one of the big top ones in the world 30 years ago, and I was hired to provide training to leaders and managers throughout the company, and I just it was a wonderful moment for me. I battled the leadership. I battled my boss. I battled his boss. I felt they were out of integrity a lot. They were manipulative. They were ambitious themselves, and it was hard for me to work for them. And so I would challenge them right and left, publicly, privately. And one day, my boss took me aside and said, "You know, Keith, you do great work. We love what you do. We think you're making a difference in these training programs. You're designing wonderful programs, but get with the program. You're fighting us too much." And basically he said, "Either stop fighting us or get out." And I decided to leave.
Yes, I remember.
I felt like what was more important to me was my integrity. And even though I was getting paid well, I was enjoying it, I was learning a lot, it didn't sit with me well. He was surprised. I think he thought I was going to say, "You're right, Sam, you know, I feel like I have been insubordinate the opposite. I said, "I'm good with what I believe in, and I'm standing firm. I don't trust you," is what I said to him. "I don't trust your boss. And as long as that's the case, you're right. I can't work here, and I'm leaving." Interestingly, the head of human resources of the whole company took me in, and I told him the same thing right to his face. And I said to him, "And frankly, if you're sticking with these guys, then I have questions about your leadership too, and why you would put up with this kind of behavior on the part of your leaders is beyond me." And he, of course, got all huffy and upset. It was I felt very affirmed. I could not be a team player in such a team. I then got hired in another very large computer company, and I loved it there, and I so respected my leader. I so respected my boss and her boss and the company in general. It was night and day for me.
This is truly a fantastic experience, because not too many can represent themselves in such a free, open mind with a conviction and be so strong in a spiritual way. We do not have time for me to ask you some intriguing question. What is your personal biography and what gave you such a tremendous human backbone? But my suspicion that you had some other components, not only your brilliant education, but some other components to that. I do not want to miss an opportunity to make a few other comments in your book. You made one statement saying that it is not a dissertation, it's not a defined protocol or something which will be formally used, but I would say that you've been very modest, because I found your book extremely illustrative. It can be a tremendously successful textbook for any institution. Your diagram is very clear. Your illustration, your examples make this invisible balance between business and human. And I found the whole experience reading this book very universal. whether it's a person in business or in art industry or just human being. It's just a fantastic statement into our society. I have to give an opportunity to say express last moments and thoughts of my very special guest, Dr. Keith Meron, after which we would have to let him go. So, Keith, your last thoughts.
Well, it has to do with the source of great leadership. And this is the thing that people don't get and they need to get, I think, in the world, is that you can't fake it till you make it. You can't read it in a book and learn the five easy steps to leadership. If you want to be a great leader, it's got to come from the deep wellspring from inside oneself. And so getting clear, who am I in this world? What matters to me most? What is immovable for me? What is my truth? What is my compass? Becomes huge. And I want to say there's a big difference between being one's own values and having one's own values. We all have values, but the truly great leaders are their values. And they are uncompromising. So it's being true to oneself and being good with oneself. That's the path of great leadership. And that's the difference between great leaders in my definition and Hitler and Stalin. They were inspiring to a lot of people on one level, but they were very tortured individuals. Ultimately, they were not good with who they were. They were very pained individuals. And because of their inner pain, they created damaging leadership in the world. And so it always comes back to healing oneself, being true to oneself in the deepest sense of who one is, that's what great leadership is all about.
I wanted to thank you deeply, especially sharing these thoughts with being with you just for less of the hour. I can imagine what kind of benefits and what kind of a worth of knowledge, integrity, and leadership your students are learning from you. I'm wishing you the best, whatever you wish for yourself.
Thank you so much.
You're
very kind. In fact, I do need to go to my students right now, but if I can put a plug for all the readers, please go to my website, remarkableleaders.com, and learn a little bit more about this body of work that I'm developing, and buy the book, and reach out to me on the internet, and I'll respond using that technology that I poo-pooed at the beginning. So thank you. I really appreciate the time.
With nice music and lovely glass of wine.
All right. Be well.
Thank you. was another program with a very outstanding person who devoted himself very selflessly to every aspect of leadership. I particularly have a tremendous respect for him because indeed he connects to young people and he connects to every problem, literally every element of the problem which we're facing in a big scale and a small scale. Well, on this note, I wanted to thank all of you for your own thoughts. And if you are enjoying the end of this program, I like to make my little moment of enjoyment and thanking BBS again for another addition, support, and just a wonderful understanding of all of us. I will see you next Tuesday. That was Lena Life. I'm Lena Mirmont. Until soon.